Good morning. So for those of you who didn't catch on, we have a split service this morning. The good news is that if you don't like what I'm saying, you only have about 20 minutes and then Kevin will get up and talk. The bad news is if we both go long, we're going to go really long. So we'll try and keep it under control.
They don't want me back.
Yeah. this morning, I'm going to be talking out of 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And whenever I jump into a passage that, you know, there's not a series or something going on, I like to look back just a little bit. And so I'm going to review just a little bit what happened right before this point in the passage. Paul is talking to the Corinthian church here in chapter 8 and 9 about spiritual freedoms, freedom in Christ. In fact, in chapter 8, you'll remember the meat offered to idols passage where he talks about the fact that there's nothing contaminated about the meat that's offered to idols. There's nothing actually wrong with the nutrition, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with partaking of it, as long as, he said, the one caveat, if you're offending brothers, perhaps somebody who just recently converted over and used to do idol worship, or a young Christian that is offended by it, that would be a reason to abstain. Then in chapter 9, Paul talks about his own personal spiritual freedoms, and he talks about how he limits them in order to make his witness more effective. So all the different groups of people that Paul witnessed to, he would sometimes abstain from things or do things that otherwise would be fine, that you'd have freedom in Christ to do. It's not wrong, but he'd abstain from them in order to make his witness more effective. So that's the basis that we come to chapter 10. I'm going to be reading through, and I'm going to make some comments a little bit different this Sunday. I'm going to make some comments kind of as I go. So let's start at 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1. "For I do not want you to be unaware, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ." Two things I want to notice here, and I'm for sake of time, I'm not going to go real in depth in a lot of this stuff. But he's talking about the children of Israel, where they came out of captivity in Egypt. He talks about the under the cloud and pass through the sea. So under the cloud, they had a cloud that would guide them by day. It would go in it, and at night they said it was a pillar of fire is what it looked like at night. And so they followed that for direction for where to go and passed through the sea. You'll remember the story of when they came to the Red Sea and the waters parted and God created a spot that they could go through on dry land. And then when the Egyptians chased them, the water went back into place. That's one of the ways that they escaped from the Egyptian army. It also says that they were baptized into Moses through the cloud and the sea. And to me, what that means is that these people, by following Moses through this dry land and through the sea, and by following that cloud, were voluntarily and unconditionally placing themselves under Moses' authority. They were choosing to follow Moses. And it's not unlike the baptisms that we're having later today. These people that are being baptized are giving us it's an outward symbol that they are voluntarily and unconditionally have placed themselves under God's authority. Let's keep reading. "Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did." God was not pleased with them, and they were overthrown in the wilderness. There's some estimates that say as many as 2 million people died while they were in the wilderness. Well over a million is most estimates. In fact, I think it's in Numbers, there's a passage that says their bodies were strewn throughout the desert. And God was not pleased. They kept falling back into sin. And we get into the examples here in a minute. But the children of Israel, that's an interesting read if you've never read through the part of the Old Testament that talks about the children of Israel from the time of captivity up through the Promised Land or wandering in the wilderness is a very interesting and quite a few lessons out of it that you can learn. From knowing of the story, I compare it to a young boy, the story of a young boy who 4 or 5 years old, and he's finally old enough to sleep in his brother's bedroom on the top bunk. And he sleeps on the top bunk, and one night he falls out of bed. And his mom comes in and gets him tucked back into bed and says, "What happened?" And the boy said, I think I must have fallen asleep too close to the edge. And I think that's the children of Israel. They kept falling asleep too close to the edge, and they kept falling back into sin. They weren't guarding their life and their hearts too well. So let's get into the examples. There's four of them. We're going to read through them, and then we're going to break them down. "Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by serpents. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, of whom the end of the ages has come." I do think it's interesting that the results, they go through what happened to these people because of their sin. And interestingly, the results happened to them as an example, but for us, it's written down for our instruction, so we can maybe avoid some of these pitfalls. But let's go through these four areas. So, do not be idolaters. The quote, "the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play," is a direct quote out of Exodus 32. And the story, for sake of time, I'm not reading the Old Testament passages that correlate with these, but the story there was Moses up in the mountain talking to God, and the people came to Aaron, who was left in charge, and said, He led us out of captivity, but what has become of him? Where is he? We need a leader that's tangible. We need something in front of us to remind us, you know, who's leading us. And so they said, build us something that represents our leadership. And so Aaron collected all their jewelry and silver and gold and created this calf. And I don't know, there's a different discussion about what Aaron's intention was with the calf, but what the people did is started worshiping the calf. That's what the people were falling back into their idol worship from Egypt that they witnessed in the Egyptian culture. So this is the point where God looks down and sees this and tells Moses, "You realize that your people are down there worshiping idols. That's what they're doing while you're up here." And in fact, God was so upset that he said, "Let my wrath burn against them. Let me destroy them. I want to start over here." And Moses pled with God to allow him to come back down and lead his people back to him. And that's ultimately what happened then. So idolatry is one of those things that's sometimes too easy to dismiss as being a problem in your own life. You can say, well, we don't have any golden calves or any golden images that we're worshiping. We don't have them in our houses. And so we're probably all right with idolatry. But the problem is that idolatry, another definition for it is it's anything that you treasure more than you treasure God. So it can be your family. It can be your spouse. It can be your work or a sport that you play, and certainly a sport that you watch and follow. It can be hobbies like golf or guns or games of any kind. It can be beauty or fitness. It starts in the heart. It's any craving or anything that you're satisfied with that you treasure more than God that is idolatry. So let's go on to the next one. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in a single day. If you're unsure of after the many passages that talk about sexual sins, if you're unsure of where God's heart is on sexual sin, on adultery and fornication, this is another reinforcing point. 23,000 people died in a single day. Sexual sin is not something that you flirt with. It's not something that you see how close to the edge you can get without falling into it. It's something that in your life, when you realize it, that there's any potential there, you got to flag that area and flee from it. You got to get away from it. It's not unlike Joseph in the story at Potiphar's house, where he ran away, and it said she caught his coat, and he just slipped out of his coat and kept running. He wasn't going to go back for his coat for fear that something might happen. So we have idolatry, sexual immorality. The next one is we must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by serpents. So this is out of Numbers 21 is where this comes out of. And it's where the children of Israel were questioning God's goodness. A lot of the things that happened out of that, a lot of the complaining and testing were the fact that they were questioning the goodness of God. Have you brought us out here into the wilderness to die? They were complaining about food. They were complaining about conditions. They had the same food every day, manna and water, and they were talking about the garlic and the onions and the fruit from back in Egypt, and they were remembering all of that. God was not happy with this attitude after he had rescued them. And so it says in the passage in Numbers, he sent fiery serpents throughout the camp, and they were biting people, and many people died. So the people came to their senses a little and came back to Moses once again and said, "We may have made a mistake by questioning God's goodness. These snakes are a bit of a problem here in the camp." So God talked to Moses, and I think it's just such a great picture of what God had Moses do in this case. He had him form a bronze snake and put it up on a pole. And anybody who got bit by a snake could look at that snake and they would be healed. God could have just as easily taken the snakes away. The snakes came at the direction of God, and he could have just as easily done that. But that's not how he chose to handle this. And what a great witness or a great example it was for years to come, for generations. It's a reminder for the ones that lived through it and for kids who look at it and say, "Why do we have a bronze snake up on a pole?" And the parents can say, "Let me tell you a little something about God's goodness." They can tell the story, and it can be a generational learning process. Let's go on to the next one. Nor grumble, as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the destroyer. So if I was making a list of serious sins, this one is an interesting one in there. We have idolatry, sexual immorality, questioning God or testing God's goodness, and then we have grumbling. We think of grumbling, and this is, granted, probably a little more serious than saying, "Boy, I don't really like the weather today." You know, it's probably a little bit more serious than that. The people were continually grumbling, and it kind of ties in a little bit with the testing God's goodness. They were grumbling about God's goodness and God's plan for their life. And in Numbers chapter 14 through 18 is kind of where it talks a lot about the grumbling. And in fact, in that passage is where God says that basically because of your grumbling and your attitudes, none of you will experience the promised land. Nobody over 20 years old, he said. And actually, God threw a little bit of their grumbling back at him and said, "The children whom you said will be prey in the wilderness, who the wild animals will feast on, those are the ones who are going to experience the promised land." Contentment is what glorifies God, and this shows how he feels about grumbling and complaining. Then he ends this passage with a warning. Or not the passage, but this at the end of this list. "Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall." And it kind of summarizes for the children of Israel. If they had taken heed and kept themselves more, they would have stayed out of a lot of trouble. I mean, we had 23,000 dying. We had fiery serpents throughout the camp. We had all these things. People, you know, over a million people that didn't make it to the promised land because of all these things. And if they had protected themselves a little better against these falling back into sin, it would have come out a lot better for them. The principle is not much. This principle is a lot the same as Proverbs 16:18, where it says, "Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall." There's a lot of examples in the Bible of it too. Peter would be one where Peter said, I'm going to be with you, Christ, even to the end of the world. Whatever happens, I'm with you. I'm one of your guys. And then a few hours later, this is just before the crucifixion, he was standing in a courtyard or standing there, and people came to him and said, Peter, aren't you the one who hung out with Jesus? Aren't you one of his main guys? And Peter said, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know the guy. I'm not. And kept denying that he even knew Christ. And Peter would have never thought it possible that he would have got to this place. He would have thought this is an area that he's so strong in, his identity with Christ, that he's with Jesus no matter what. And yet it's the exact area that he fell. The Arabs and Israelis have been fighting since before Paul wrote these words back in Bible times. And in the 60s, in the 1960s, there was a particularly contentious time in their relationship. Relationship is a stretch, but in their warrings. And in fact, I think it was in 67, there's a period of time we call the Six-Day War, which was a particularly bloody time. But around that time, the Arabs took control of an area called Golan Heights. And Golan Heights had a strategic advantage because it was cliffside at the Israeli side of the, it was a cliff. So they were up on a high area looking down over Israeli land. And behind them was all Arab controlled and fortified area. And so they had this advantage. They would shoot down into towns and cities, rockets and different artillery, whatever they had in the 60s that they could shoot down. They'd do this. And the Israelis were not happy with this arrangement. So finally, one night, they took huge bulldozers and they went up to this cliffside at Golan Heights and they started pushing rocks up to it. And they went up and they knocked rocks down and they finally got to the place where they could push tanks up over this hill. And so they kept doing that through the night, pushing tanks up over. And when the Arabs woke up in the morning, there was a number of Israeli tanks and Israeli soldiers that had followed up behind there. And the battle was very short-lived, and the Arabs basically, some witnesses say they threw their guns down and ran, but basically they ran away and chased them several miles to where they were on level ground, and they set up a new battle area. The Arabs thought they had an advantage that they didn't even need to protect. This cliff was the strong point. They were protecting the other lines where they were on level ground, but what they weren't protecting was that cliffside. And that's so often, and that's exactly what cost them thousands of lives and to lose that battle. And so often in our own lives, it's there too. It's that area where you think, I'm fortified. This is not a spot that I'll have to protect, that we're prone to fall in. So lest we get discouraged, the last verse we're going to read here is instead of all warnings, we have an encouragement here. Verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. So I want to look at a few words in 13 to kind of break it down a little bit. It's a verse that's pretty common to everybody, because it is a promise and it's reassuring. But let's first of all look at the word temptation. Temptation in the Greek root word that it comes from, and I'm not a Greek scholar. This comes from trusting other people that they know what they're talking about. But the Greek word for temptation does not have a moral good or bad slant to it. It's actually determined by the context of the passage. So the same word. Sometimes the same root word sometimes gets translated test or trial. And we often think of a test or a trial as being a good thing, and we think of temptation as being a bad thing, but it's actually a lot of times the same root word that it comes from. James talks a lot about, in James chapter 1, he talks a lot about temptations and trials. I'm actually going to read just a few verses jumping into James 1, verse 12. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he has stood the test of time, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. So a few things back in relation to 1 Corinthians that I want to look with the word temptation. it's pretty clear God never and cannot be the source of your temptation. So he can be the source of a trial or a test, as we see in Job in a few spots, but he's not the source of your temptation. So temptations begin with our individual desires. So Carl has been talking a lot about the desires of your heart and the old man's desires versus the godly desires. And these old man desires is where the temptations come from. They come out of that. So you can go through a trial without having temptations, but your desires is what creates those temptations. And then the third thing is that temptation, when it's succumbed to, ultimately leads to death. And sometimes that's helpful when you're in a trial or a temptation to realize that where this goes, instead of saying it's just a little change, it's a huge deal, ultimately, when you succumb to temptations. So going back then, no temptation has overcome you that is not common to man. Common to man there is, it's kind of phrased a little bit odd, but it's basically reassuring us that the trials and the temptations that we go through are not different than other humans go through. We sometimes want to isolate ourselves and say that we are the only one that struggles with this particular spot, or we're the only one that's going through this. And that can lead to depression, but it also can often lead to an excuse to fall. Because if I'm the only one that experiences this, obviously, you know, if nobody else went through this, I have a reason why I'm going to succumb to that temptation. So you can be rest assured that your temptations are not different than other people's. Now, we all are tempted in different ways, but as humans, there's not one person that gets temptations that are just different or that they can't withstand. So God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. So the key words I see, and I probably should have had the way, but way of escape and to endure it. So that's the pattern through trials and temptations, is to go through it. The way of escape is not a dodge or getting away from the trial. The way of escape is actually going through it. And that's so counter to my human nature, because I find myself, when I pray for other people who are going through a trial, my prayer goes along this line: Lord, help them to learn what you want them to learn through this trial, and give them strength and help them to endure and suffer well. And, you know, we use phrases like that. And then when we're in a trial, my prayers sound a little bit more like, woe is me and please get me out of here. But that's not the pattern that we see here. The promise is God is faithful, that he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But the way that the promise is fulfilled is the way of escape to go through it. He gives you the ability to go through it. So that is as far as we're taking this passage this morning. I haven't made a whole lot of practical applications, but that's because the Holy Spirit within you, and you're better at making practical applications for yourself in these four areas that the children of Israel fell, or the areas that you are overconfident in. We all have those areas. We all have areas that we're too confident, or that we're falling asleep a little too close to the edges and at risk of falling back into sin. But God is faithful, and he won't let you be tempted beyond your ability, but he'll give you a way through the trial that you're in. Thank you for your attention. We're going to turn the time over to Kevin.